Another of the differences between science and Buddhism, as I see them, lies in what constitutes a valid hypothesis. Here, too, Popper's delineation of the scope of a strictly scientific question represents a great insight. This is the Popperian falsifiability thesis, which states that any scientific theory must contain within it the conditions under which it may be shown to be false. For example, the theory that God created the world can never be a scientific one, because it cannot contain an explanation of the conditions under which the theory could be proven false. If we take this criterion seriously, then many questions that pertain to our human existence, such as ethics, aesthetics, and spirituality, remain outside the domain of science. By contrast, the domain of inquiry in Buddhism is not limited to the objective. It also encompasses the subjective world of experience as well as the question of values. In other words, science deals with empirical facts but not with metaphysics and ethics, whereas for Buddhism, critical inquiry into all three is essential. Popper's falsifiability thesis resonates with a major methodological principle in my own Tibetan Buddhist philosophical tradition. We might call this the principle of the scope of negation. This principle states that there is a fundamental difference between that which is not found and that which is found not to exist. If I look for something and fail to find it, this does not mean that the thing I am seeking does not exist. Not seeing a thing is not the same as seeing its non-existence. In order for there to be a coincidence between not seeing a thing and seeing its non-existence, the method of searching and the phenomenon being sought must be commensurate. For example, not seeing a scorpion on the page you are reading is adequate proof that there is no scorpion on the page. For if there were a scorpion on the page, it would be visible to the naked eye. However, not seeing acid in the paper on which the page is printed is not the same as seeing that the paper is acid-free, because to see acid in the paper, one might require tools other than the naked eye. Additionally, the 14th century philosopher Tsongkhapa argues there is a similar distinction between that which is negated by reason and that which is not affirmed by reason, as well as between that which cannot withstand critical analysis and that which is undermined by such analysis. These methodological distinctions may seem abstruse, but they can have significant ramifications for one's understanding of the scope of scientific analysis. For example, the fact that science has not proven the existence of God does not mean that God does not exist for those who practice in a theistic tradition. Likewise, just because science has not proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that beings take rebirth doesn't mean reincarnation isn't possible. In science, the fact that we have not so far found life on any planet but our own does not prove that life does not exist elsewhere. So by the mid-1980s, on my numerous trips from India, I had met many scientists and philosophers of science and had participated in various conversations with them, both in public and in private. Some of these, especially at the beginning, were not very fruitful. In Moscow, once at the height of the Cold War, I had a meeting with some scientists where my discussion of consciousness met with an immediate attack on the religious concept of the soul, which they thought I was advocating. In Australia, a scientist opened his presentation with a somewhat hostile statement about how he was there to defend science if there was to be an attack on it from religion. However, 1987 marked an important stage in my engagement with science. This was the year the first Mind and Life conference took place at my residence in Dharamsala. The meeting was organized by the Chilean neuroscientist Francisco Varela, who taught in Paris, and the American businessman Adam Engel. Varela and Engel approached me with a proposal that they bring together a group of scientists from various disciplines who were sympathetic to the spirit of dialogue and that we engage in an open-ended and informal private discussion that would last for a week. I leapt at this idea. It was an extraordinary opportunity to learn much more about science and to find out about the latest research and progress in scientific thinking. All the participants at the first meeting were so enthusiastic that the process has continued to this day, with a week-long meeting every 2 years.